You know what? There was such a nice quote that I read in this book, okay, about laughter. It says, laughter is a form of egalitarian play between people and reflects an ability to relinquish control and follow someone else's lead. I love that. I really love that because it really just highlights this, like, you know, power differential. Brown dads and their kids expecting them to study all day or to do this or that all day, you know.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
What's up, bondhus? This is the Desi Condition. I'm Tanushree, the creator of the show, and I'm joined today by Anu, who is the Desi Condition's communications lead. And today we will continue our conversation on South Asian parenting and emotional intimacy in parent-child relationships, which we started last time. This episode arc was inspired by a book on emotional intimacy that we just both read. It was called The Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents by Dr. Lindsay C. Gibson. She is a clinical psychologist. And we loved the book. I read it first. I loved it so much that I was like, Anu, I have to get you a copy of this. And I sent it to her immediately. I don't even think I got her permission. I just sent it. But we also realized that it wasn't culturally specific or necessarily inclusive. And so we decided to branch out and add something to it from a more South Asian perspective. And so in our last episode, we talked about South Asian parenting habits. And more specifically, we kind of discussed the emotional intimacy in parent-child relationships, like I mentioned, and how our culture views and deals with emotions and how that in turn affects the socialization of children. So Anu, hi, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing great this morning. I had to check to see what time it was. For some reason, I thought it was 1 p.m.
Oh, you know what? Quick detour. Today is August 15th that we're recording this, and that is India's Independence Day.
Yeah, I just realized that. I just realized that.
Which means yesterday was Pakistan.
Yes. I'm cool. So out of touch.
What a fitting time. I think that that stuff is like kind of relevant to what we talked about last time and this time. So this all feels very fitting. All the stars have really aligned for this. Anyway, so Anu, I have a question for you. Based on the last episode, what was the most interesting or your favorite part of the episode?
Honestly, there were a lot of things that we talked about in our last episode that were eye-opening for me. Even as we were recording, Tanushree and I had met to just get all of our thoughts down, all our research down, but I feel like I really learned the most when we were recording. And one of the things that I loved about our last episode was the part where we spoke about the legacies of partition on mental health. Now, there was this misconception, or there seems to be this misconception, that mental health awareness and resources and just taking care of yourself is not a thing within our culture. And after we conducted some research and I was looking into it, I learned that the silence of psychiatrists was not due to a lack of awareness, but because there was a lack of documenting the psychological trauma. And there was no relief, there were no resources, and so there was such an upheaval. And a lot of that responsibility was left to local family and community networks. Now, this translated over to an entire generation not taking care of their own mental health, and that was passed down to our grandparents and to our parents and to us eventually. And I think that's such an important realization to come to as we were recording our last episode and just talking about how South Asians don't necessarily believe that emotional intimacy is a thing and is not even a part of our relationships with one another, especially parent-child relationships. So I thought that was so interesting, and I feel like it was such a circle back for us to come to.
Yeah, for me, one of the highlights, I think, was when we discussed the research studies. And I will say the research studies are more based on mothers than fathers, you know, which is a whole issue in itself. But at least we have some conclusion from it, that they conclude basically that the South Asian moms don't necessarily disregard emotion. It's that they tend to encourage their kids to move on from these emotions, particularly if they're ones that take away from harmony of the group, right? Remember, we're a collectivist mm-hmm. culture. So taking away from harmony, right? That's not what we want. And that historically, there's been an emphasis on the expression of emotion, opposite to what I think we perceive our parenting to be. But there has always been an expression of emotion and an emphasis on that. If you just look to the arts, the poetry, dance, etc. And also the conclusion that happiness is seen as an immature emotion. And I think that we said that that was even true in ancient India and still rings true today. So the adult counterparts of happiness are supposed to be more contentment. And the idea is that only children can really feel like a true joy like that because they are not encumbered by, you know, the weight of the world, basically. They're not aware of the dichotomies and the, like, the injustices of the world, pretty much.
I think we also talked about how parents, South Asian parents, make it their responsibility to kind of rob children of that innocence that they also revere so highly. So it's like, as parents, they want to teach us that stoicism of like, don't get too excited, or, you know, don't lean into joy too much, or don't lean into pain too much. Just don't lean into anything too much because it has to pass. And I find that so interesting because it's almost like they're enamored by the innocence of a child being able to feel these feelings so deeply, and yet they're teaching them to do the complete opposite.
Also, honestly, what I really love about this is that it takes away the Eurocentric focus that I think a lot of us theorize on when we talk about parenting. It is true that colonization obviously had a big impact. If you're from any part of Bengal, like the Bengali Liberation War was another thing. I agree that colonization obviously has a big impact. I think that there's not much else that like Anu and I can really add to that conversation that's not already been said on hundreds of other publications, right? So I just love that we can say that this type of thinking, like this view on happiness, goes even further. And maybe I like to think that maybe colonization, what it actually did was aggravate that view rather than create that view.
Yeah, that's really deep. And I think I think a lot of the times when there are conversations around this, like it just ends at colonization. It's just like, well, once we were colonized, we were robbed of all of these, you know, multiple things. But if you look deeper into our culture, and if you look much deeper, much further back, there were already these values that were exacerbated, like you mentioned. Due to colonization. So if Desi culture had already incorporated this stoicism to begin with, which I also want to say is I don't want to necessarily paint it in a bad way, but I do think that any form of like healthy relationship with it was probably worsened, and there was a lot of fear that came with that as well. So not only did we have these stoic principles that we were living with, that we were teaching our children, that we ourselves were following, but now we're living in a culture where we're just terrified and, you know, looking towards survival. So we're going to use all those principles and heighten them to a point of not even understanding how unhealthy it is. So I do want to say that that's my opinion, and that those are my views on it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like to think of it that way as well. And I think it gives us a little more, I was going to say a little more credit, like it's a good thing, but it puts the onus on us a little bit more too, as well.
Yeah, it does. It does. It holds us accountable.
So transitioning away from that, that was all last episode, which you should listen to. We should stop giving so much away. You guys should just listen to it. What kind of marketing is this? So you guys need to go listen to the last episode. Clearly, it was very illuminating and very interesting and deep and thoughtful. But let's get into today's episode. So, Anu, what are our overarching questions for the day?
Ooh, these are some heavy questions. And again, We're just going to
continue.
We don't
do light
from
questions
part
here.
one.
Have we ever done light
No.
questions here? No.
No. I think we did. We've had some lighter episodes, but this won't be one of
That might
them.
be true.
So the next few questions, I think are things that we want to ask ourselves, and to all of our listeners. I'm sure like these questions also popped up in your minds as you were listening to part one, but we want to specifically focus on these three as we move forward with this episode. So, first question, what does emotional immaturity look like, and what are the various types? Two, how does a parent or parents' emotional immaturity impact their children? And three, how do we detach ourselves from expectations so we can see our parents for who they really are instead of who we have made them to be in our minds?
I know. Can you believe we're going to do this in 1 hour? Let's see what we can
This
do.
is, yeah, I'm just like, wow, like we're really going there. We're really going there with these questions. Oh man. Let's start with enmeshment.
Yeah. I think, like, when we think about South Asian culture, we think about collectivism, but also that can go wrong. That can go awry very quickly if you do too much of it, which is also true, by the way, for individualism. Too much of anything is a bad thing. So what we were thinking about when we read about enmeshment was specifically two things: mother-son relationships in South Asia, or among South Asians, and also oldest-daughter relationships.
Yeah, so these two, I think these two are prime examples of boundaryless relationships. So let's take it a step back and talk about what emotional enmeshment even is. Emotional incest and enmeshment, like what does it mean? So that means, like I said, no boundaries, and the way that they can manifest is a lack of privacy between parents and children. Parents expecting children to be their best friends and always confiding in them. And even I've seen a lot of the times parents having some sort of right over their child and their decisions and the way that they act and what they choose to do in their day-to-day lives. So there is a lack of boundaries, a lack of mutual respect, and fitting into certain roles and expectations that have been set in stone already that don't change. So there is a lack of dynamic relationship building. There is a lack of real relatedness and more of role playing involved with enmeshment. And with mother-son relationships, I think that we see this so much in Desi culture where they play favorites and mothers will play favorites with their sons most of the time, a lot of the times, especially, and I've seen it in India a lot, where it's almost like a, it's like a, it's almost like a cute thing. It's not seen as something that's like problematic at all. But there are so many problematic implications and just like consequences to mother-son relationships that have no boundaries and where the sons are favorited over the daughters or whatever, even large families. Like if there's like a there's one son and like three daughters or one son and one daughter, like the son will usually be the favorite of the mother. And it's just like a thing that passes down from generation to generation. And so what happens when what happens when that son becomes an adult? That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about how that manifests like as an adult for like an adult son in a family that has been the favorite. What happens when he's a grown man and has experienced this relationship with his mother where it's completely enmeshed and there's just a lack of a boundary, lack of emotional boundaries. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all, Dhanashree, but I have a few things to say.
One thing I will say is that it is based on a dependency. So it's not even necessarily closeness. It's like favoritism is not necessarily a sign of closeness. And I don't think that the parent is aware that this is what they're doing. I think they see this as a closeness, but actually what they're doing is keeping their sons near. And so you hear about these sons who can't take care of themselves, and like they marry women, but really they're just marrying mothers. So that's what I think about when I think about enmeshment. And then the opposite case, I think, is with the oldest daughter trope that we see so much, that I guess I can't speak to too much because I'm the youngest daughter. But from what I have heard from oldest daughters that I know, it's basically the complete opposite. Like, they don't feel like they were taken care of. They don't feel like they have any, like, close relationship with their parents, really. They feel like a lot of pressure. They don't. The boundary thing is true. No boundaries, but in a different way.
Yeah. I can speak to the oldest daughter relationship. I am the oldest in my family, and I feel like I have experienced, I think for me, it was less about closeness. It was more of like this expectation to be a certain way and be this, like, uphold certain values and to fit into a role very similar to what I said earlier. These traditional roles that are kind of like projected onto us as children, like as a child, like as an older daughter, I had this role projected onto me that I had to be a certain way as the oldest, that I had to be this model citizen, and I had to be an example for my sister. And anything that didn't fall into that was regarded as like the worst thing that you could possibly do in the world. And then there was that sense of shame and guilt that always followed. What I noticed was when I would call it out as I got older, because I noticed that my parents were much easier on my younger sister, I was told, well, you're the oldest. And it just would end there. You're the oldest. You know, we had to be like hard on you. We had to be hard on you. You were the oldest and we had to set an example. And I want to talk about that because I think that the collective principle of, I guess, like having like a herd mentality, like people mimic behaviors that they see, like in the same group, at least in the same family, like that, I think that's something that South Asian families really play into. Like, they're more worried about what type of example they're setting for other people rather than actually evaluating the situation for what it is. And a good example of that is if let's say an older child, an older daughter needs more emotional intimacy within her relationship with her parents, or needs to feel as though she can rely on them emotionally. Setting that example would be parents would, instead of actually trying to understand why or trying to build real closeness with that child, they'd be more concerned with like, well, what does that mean for us in general? You know, if we do that with you, then we're going to do that with the rest of our children. And we want to treat you as though you're strong, and we want you to uphold like our family values. And so the archetype of strong, independent, and, you know, self-reliant, that archetype had to be fulfilled as a firstborn. And then the parents realize, of course, over time, like, what that does to a child and the consequences. And usually what happens is with an oldest daughter and a parent, there's a lot of friction and there's a lack of understanding, and there is always resentment that comes from that lack of understanding. And then it becomes too much. And depending on like the family and depending on, again, like the type of relationship that an older daughter has with her parents, like it can either get really ugly or they can drift apart and have a really strained relationship. And parents normally don't want to, they feel the emotional toll on themselves, whether they admit it or not, but then they don't want to go through with that with the second child and the third child and the fourth child. And so they ease off a little bit, and they kind of like, they don't impose those values on them as much. They give them room to breathe, and they give them those boundaries that the first child really, really wanted. So I find that really interesting, but I feel as though that, that role filling, the expectation to fill a role is upheld so high with the firstborn that it has to come down after the first child is born. Typically, that's what happens, and that I've seen that happen not just with myself, but in so many families, so many South Asian families. The firstborn's always like more traumatized in some way, just because of those like projections, you know, and those expectations that are placed on them. It's such a responsibility, and we always feel like the weight of that responsibility, even if it's like unsaid and like it's just implicit.
Yeah, there's also an expectation for the oldest sibling, typically the daughter, to be taking care of the parents too. So this is like a lifelong thing. This is not even just growing up,
right? Yeah, I think
so. It's kind of like the mother son, but in reverse.
In reverse,
in a way.
Yeah, in a weird way. I think with the mother son situation, I feel, and I don't think this is true for all situations, but I do feel sometimes Mothers have a need for emotional intimacy that they may not get from their partner. So the husband, so the father may not give them that that closeness and that emotional fulfillment because of that, because there is a lack of intimacy within that relationship. And so mothers turn to sons to help them fulfill that without even again, this is all unconscious, but it's almost like I have a right over you because you're my son, you're my child, and so I have to be close to you, and so you have to be close to me, and you have to tell me everything that's going on with you. I'm like, and there's again like that the role comes before the relationship itself, the role comes before the relatedness itself, and I feel like that takes precedence over real relationship building within our culture. And with the sons, I feel like there is some level of guilt that they experience and that they feel when their mothers tell them that they feel left out, or when they feel like, oh, well, you're not telling me, and like you're they get upset with the boundary setting. They get really upset. They don't understand, and it's like they have this like part of them that this void that needs to be filled because they themselves don't have that intimacy with their partner. So then they have to look to the next male in the house to help them fulfill that, and that's emotional incest.
So then this is one of the examples of emotional immaturity. Let's just talk about what emotional maturity looks like before we talk about everything else. There's a lot more to say about different kind of immaturity types and the tropes and everything. So, okay, so here we go. I'm going to read this word for word. The American Psychological Association, the APA, defines emotional maturity as a high and appropriate level of emotional control and expression. Emotional maturity is a person's ability to manage their emotions and life stressors in a healthy manner. Emotional maturity plays an important role in relationships as it helps us resolve conflicts and enter into satisfying and secure relationships. So while we were reading the book, The Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, some of the signs of emotionally mature parents were parents who are realistic and reliable. So people who work with reality without fighting it, people can feel and think at the same time. People are consistent, don't take everything personally. There's the respectful and reciprocal types. They respect your boundaries. There's like a give and take in the relationship. So they give back, they're flexible, they're even tempered, and they are honest with their kids, and they're able to apologize too when they realize that they've done something wrong. And there's like a self-awareness there. And also parents who are responsive, that's a sign of maturity, right? Their empathy is able to make you feel emotionally safe, make you feel seen, understood, make you feel comfortable, and they also enjoy providing comfort. And like I said, again, they can reflect on their actions, try to change. And also, they're just enjoyable to be around, and they're able to laugh and play.
There are so many of these that I feel like are seen as weak in our Desi culture, weak and almost like I can't even think of a father doing any of these things. I'm thinking of a mother doing a lot of these things, but a father, I don't know.
You know what? I was thinking about my dad too when I said that, because he was very much no laughter, no play, just study.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's,
I can't
that's
even remember, like, did my dad even crack a joke once? I don't think my father has once made a joke in my childhood.
My parents did joke too, but they had dry humor, very, very dry humor, extremely. I think that was the only type of humor that I was exposed to as a child. And so, I had a funny, well, I thought it was funny. Some people don't think it's funny, but I was exposed to one type of humor and as a kid, and I was shocked that there were other types of humor in this world by the time I was in school.
So, that is kind of funny.
Yeah, I was like, what? Was I supposed to laugh at that?
You know what? There was such a nice quote that I read in this book, okay, about laughter. And says, laughter is a form of egalitarian play between people and reflects an ability to relinquish control and follow someone else's lead. I love that. I really love that because it really just highlights this, like, you know, power differential. Brown dads and their kids expecting them to study all day or to do this or that all day, you know.
Oh, and that kind of speaks to the patriarchy too. Not kind of, it really does. Like the
And mothers do
control
this too.
factor. Mothers definitely do this. I also feel like this exists between mother and father, like their relationships. Also, there's like a level of like don't cross a line, or I've seen it. I want to talk about the different types of emotionally mature parents. So in the book, there are four different types that are described. All of them are described as being self-preoccupied, containing low empathy, are insensitive, and demonstrate poor communication strategies. So the four are emotional parents, driven parents, passive parents, and rejecting parents. And I'm going to spend like 30 seconds kind of describing each. So the emotional parents are typically characterized by instability. They're overwhelmed by their anxiety. They lose emotional balance. And the impact of this on children is them experiencing constant despair, rage, or hatred, and they can be overly attentive to other people's feelings and moods. They typically feel like they're walking on eggshells and they're just waiting for their parent or parents to kind of have this emotional breakdown so that they have to pick up the pieces. So a parent has to essentially grow up and parent their parent. The second type is the driven parent, which who is I believe in the book they describe this type to be seen as the most high functioning, so quote unquote normal. They're always focused on getting things done, and they try to perfect everyone, and they come off as controlling and interfering, and they give only selective praise. So normally, how this plays out is you're seen as a worthy child or a good enough child if you have accomplished things that your parents deem as deem to be good and worthy of praise. So the way that this manifests in relationships is like always having to go above and beyond to be a go-getter and to achieve things, but love feels very conditional. At least I that's been my that was my experience, and that's just what I have also like noticed in families where there are driven parents. Like they're typically so busy with their lives, like they're hustling, they're working, they're taking care of businesses, they're taking care of multiple children. Like a lot of the times these parents have a lot of things on their plate, and so the relationship with them just goes so far as to like make sure that they have you have a roof over your head, you have food on the table, and that they're pushing you. And that's their way of showing love. Like that's their way of showing quote unquote love. They're pushing you to become the best version of themselves. And something that I heard all the time is we just don't want you to go through what we did, so that's why we're hard on you. And
Yeah,
that's
that's a
seen as
very
like
familiar
love.
one among the South Asians.
Yeah. And I think this is like I like I don't want to make a generalization, but I feel like this is a very, very South Asian like statement. Like we don't want you to suffer or go through what we did, so we're gonna be hard on you before life shows you how hard it is. But
Yeah, and not for nothing, they're not wrong. Like
they're not
my dad
wrong.
came to this country, he got a master's, he got a PhD. Like I didn't see him for the first few years of my life. I only saw him for like a few hours a day because he was just working so much. He had two jobs. Like
Yeah.
it was a grind. Like I get it.
Yeah.
He was
Yeah.
definitely a driven type.
Yeah. The third type is the passive type, which is this type is a little sad because this type normally is the most lovable parent, and this is the parent that a child feels the closest to, and so it can be really confusing when they're going through this experience. A passive parent avoids anything upsetting. They may even allow abuse by looking the other way. They love you, but they cannot help you. And like I mentioned, they're often the most lovable parent. So this parent actually makes me think about what you said earlier, the reliable and responsible parent. Like the passive parent does not embody that. This parent is just kind of around for the good times and will can be affectionate towards a child, but they're not going to actually protect them in any way. And when a child experiences passive parenting, they're kind of it's confusing for them because they know that they're loved, but they don't feel safe. And so they have to protect themselves, or they have to kind of either they have to learn how to protect themselves, or they learn that the world is not a safe place, and that just distorts their entire view of what safety looks like in relationships. And
there
may even be like a denial towards accepting that a parent was not there for them in the way that they needed to be there for them. So the book talks about that too. Like there was,
and I
think
I don't
there
know
was
if
like
you
one.
Mentioned this. I think the worst case scenario of that is that parent, when there's a different parent who is actively abusive and the passive parent just kind of looks the other way. That's like the extreme type.
Exactly. And then a child is kind of like, well, at least that parent was not abusing me. That parent wasn't the one who hurt me. But
which is incorrect.
They did. Right. But they did. And lastly is the rejecting parent. This parent demonstrates no empathy. This parent is really detached. Children come to see themselves as a burden or as an irritant, and then they have a hard time asking for what they need as adults. In the book, this type was kind of described as a parent that didn't necessarily even want to be a parent. So like other things in their lives took precedence over their children. And so the child is left feeling like, well, why did you even have me? You know, if your job is more important, or if your other responsibilities or your other like hobbies and interests are more important, then where do I fit in to your busy schedule, or where do I fit into your, you know, to your prioritization? And this is a really sad one because there is like a lack of worthiness factor here that manifests in a child. And especially as an adult, they have no idea how to even ask for what they need because they never felt needed to or wanted to begin with.
You know, yesterday I read, and I'm going to have to find the source on this, but I read that 1 out of 5 parents regret having children. So
I read
I think,
the same thing.
Where did we read that? We're gonna have to dig for this.
I don't know.
It was
know.
Probably
I read
like
it,
on Instagram.
I have like the news app like on my phone, and like I just get these random articles all the time. I read it and I was holy crap.
We're probably getting the same stuff on our phones because we like talk about the same stuff all the time. So anyway, my point was that I think a lot more parents fall into this rejecting type, even on like a more smaller or like a more subtle way than we realize probably.
Yeah. I know for me, I like my parents definitely fell into the driven bucket. They were as loving as they knew how to be and could be. But I think that they were definitely pushing my sister and I to become something. And they kind of taught us that in the realm of emotional like intimacy, like I don't think that was ever like a thing for them. They didn't teach us that. They didn't give us that. They didn't teach us that. They were loving in their own ways, but they were too busy trying to push us to become something of ourselves. And we felt that as children, like as little kids, I knew like I had to do something. I had to be something. Because I have to make my parents proud. And yet, like, what they don't realize is when a child absorbs that information and just internalizes it, their lack of worth and their sense of self also comes from that. And so then that child feels unworthy and feels almost like useless when they're not, you know, when they're not hustling and when they're not working hard and when they're not as driven as their parents are. And it's a very confusing experience. Like I know for me, it has been such a journey and it's been such an experience trying to figure out, you know, where I get my sense of like, you know, worth from. And like, I had to redefine that over time. I mean, I'm 31 now, about to turn 32 next month. Insane. But it has taken me so many years to actually like unpack all that. But I think a lot of it comes from this driven parent archetype that I'm so used to and so accustomed to.
Mm-hmm. I think that also leads nicely into the effects of emotionally immature parents on adult children. So like one of the things that you just talked about reminded me of this trope of the quote unquote little adult child. You know, when there's a little kid and every adult around them is like, wow, this kid is so great. This kid is basically a little adult. Or
they
even their
love
parents
that.
Are like, oh, this kid is so emotionally mature. Like they can do this and that for themselves. This is not a good thing. Children are not supposed to be that self-sufficient.
No.
They're like, you know, they're well behaved, they're obedient. They're not supposed to be that perfect. They're not supposed to be little adults. It's not normal. What actually is happening is that's a child overextending themselves to be the adult in the relationship, because the actual adult in their life is not being the adult.
Yeah, it's disorienting. You know, how many times have you seen like a little child that is maybe like, I don't know, like 7, 8 years old or 10 years old, and they have a sibling that's like 3 years old, 2 or 3 years old, and then you watch that older sibling taking care of their little sibling, and you're like, you're
it happens
children.
A lot. It happens a lot. I'm a high school teacher. I'm a high school math teacher, and it happens a lot in high school too, where these 14, 15-year-olds are taking care of their elementary age siblings.
Yeah, and I don't, and I'm not talking about like just, you know, supporting them. I mean like really taking care of them.
Yeah,
like acting like a caregiver.
Help them with their homework, cook for them, help them with their like, you know, emotional issues, like every, like they're the parent, and they
like
themselves
parenting.
Need
yeah.
a parent.
Yeah,
yeah. I know high school kids, they're not mature, they can't be parents to little kids. Like I would know. I'm not gonna get into that. Listen, I love my job. I feel like I need to say that.
I think you do.
I do. I really do. I don't think there's even been one episode that I have not mentioned being a high school math teacher. I just go on and on about it. I do. I really do. But they're not adults. I do have to say that.
They're not. And I have seen that so much in like South Asian culture, where I've like seen like, I went to India in January, and I hadn't been to India in 6 years. It had been a while. And I had like, there were like second cousins, third cousins were there. And a lot of them have little kids that are like 9 years old, 10 years old. And then they have younger siblings, and these kids were taking care of their younger siblings. And I'm like, and the worst part was that the parents were like so proud. They were just like, oh, mm-hmm. look, they're so self-sufficient. You know, she's so grown up for her age. She's so mature. Like she just takes care of everything and everyone.
Yeah,
it's
especially
so
when
nice.
They start
it's
taking
so
care of the parents. That's an issue.
I was like, shouldn't she be playing at like age 9 right now? She should just be playing outside or like playing with the other kids. Like she shouldn't be like feeding her little brother who's like 2 years old or like, you know, taking care of him. Like it was a little disorienting to me, but I noticed
it's one
that...
thing to help with the care of a child as an older sibling. It's one thing to help, but it's another thing to just take on that responsibility entirely.
Right. Like I felt like they were taking on like primary caregiver responsibilities, where like the parents could be off like doing whatever they wanted to, like socializing. So I found that to be really weird, but it's looked at like highly. Like they're like children that do that, like that type of behavior, they're given a lot of praise for that. And so of course, like a child, they don't understand what's happening. Like if they're going to get praise, they're going to keep doing it. And then what are they going to do over time? They're going to learn like, oh, my needs don't matter. It's like how useful I am matters. What I can mm-hmm. do for other people matters. Like that's where mm-hmm. I become a good person. But I'm not allowed to think of myself first, because I have to think of other people first. And as an adult, when you've internalized that, it is so, so, so harmful to your mental health, and it's so harmful to your sense of self-worth. We've all seen it. I've seen it, and it's almost like I've seen grown adults that have internalized that that's okay, and they have a really hard time like in their personal like their one-to-one relationships, like friendships, relationships, mm-hmm. like they have a really hard time like understanding how to set boundaries.
Those are the people who end up in the relationships with people that they have to take care of, people who can't really do much for themselves, never learned to cook, never called the doctor to make an appointment, that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. We want to talk about the effects, like we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. when we start talking about other things. So what are the effects of emotionally mature parents on adult children? First and foremost, the lack of connection and loneliness. I want to say something to remember is that you're not needy just because you want to connect, even if you're being told otherwise. There is this sense of don't be weak and don't be needy and don't be too senty. I hear the word senty a lot from Daisy's, like don't be too sentimental, don't be so emotional, don't be so emo, don't be so emotional. Like I've heard that word being thrown around often when people want to connect emotionally, there's just this like notion that keep it to yourself. And the loneliness just is, it exists. I know the book talks about like experiences of children that have emotionally immature parents. They have this like, they have this very distinct experience of loneliness that follows them throughout their life. I 100% resonated with that. And it was like, when I read that, I was like, holy crap. Like, it wasn't, you know, this is something that a lot of us have experienced, but that none of us spoke about. Or if we did speak about it, we kind of thought that there was something wrong with us internally, but that there is an experience of being disconnected from those around you, and especially from your parents, because of that lack of emotional intimacy. So what is this? What happens? This breeds the role self. This breeds a healing fantasy. And either you become an internalizer or an externalizer. And we'll talk about this later on in the episode, very soon. But the impact on children are, you can go one way or another way, the internalizer versus the externalizer. And then we'll talk about the role self, and we'll talk about the healing fantasy in a little bit. But essentially, children have to become self-sufficient, well-behaved, obedient, little adult children, which like we talked about, which isn't normal. And then they end up overextending themselves as adults. There's a quote from the book that says, using close relationships for reassurance and support is one of the traits that help people survive extreme life-threatening conditions.
Whew. You mean like partition?
Just
an
like
occupation?
An occupation. Yep. Exactly. Let's talk about internalizers and externalizers. This I found so interesting. I have a very, I've got a personal anecdote for this one. So in the book, the children can either become internalizers or they can become externalizers. And just a disclaimer, the book talk goes really in depth for internalizers. There's a lot of different strategies, a lot of anecdotes that the book focuses on for internalizers, and they kind of take away from the externalizers. And once I define the two, I'll kind of talk about what I mean, like what my issues are with that. But an internalizer is essentially someone who takes responsibility for things. They believe that it's up to them to change things. They're very self-reflective, introspective people. They learn from their mistakes. And they sometimes end up in very lopsided relationships where they do most of the emotional work, and they do not recognize abuse for what it is, such as gaslighting, which is one example. But essentially, the book mentions that these are the types of people that are interested in self-growth and self-personal development. They want to be reflective. They want to evolve and become better people. And those are the types of people that actually gravitate towards the books like the one that we just read. They're essentially seen as people who take more responsibility than they should. One quote from the book, which I thought was so strong. Unfortunately, being counted on isn't the same thing as being loved, and the emotional emptiness of the strategy eventually becomes apparent. This is so heartbreaking. So
is this
heartbreaking.
Oldest daughter syndrome?
I think so. I do think so. But I think that so many people can resonate with this, whether you're an oldest daughter or not. I really do think that the reliability is synonymous to worthiness, and it's not real. It's not healthy. It's not real. And I think that like deep down as children, we know this to some regard, but it's only until we're adults and we realize that we have full agency over our decisions that we feel kind of trapped in these roles where we're like, well, I never got to do that as a kid. Why do I get to do that now? So that one really
hits
me.
Often the body's natural response to this tends to be depression, anxiety, chronic tension, which like kind of consume you so that you start taking care of yourself. Hopefully. Yeah. I mean,
those physical and those mental, like those conditions, it's confusing because it's like you tell yourself like, oh, I'm fine, but then it's like, oh, I've been suffering from insomnia for like weeks on end, and you don't understand like why that is, and it's like the body is almost like trying to communicate something to you, that you refuse to understand.
You know what's interesting? I mentioned this briefly in the last episode too, the first part of this series, that among South Asians, certain mental health disorders such as depression, anxiety, etc., tend to present themselves somatically in South Asians. That is true more for South Asians, I think, than many other races, interestingly enough. I don't know the reasons or the research behind this, but that is a fact that came out of a certain study, maybe multiple studies. So you think about like gastrointestinal issues, which is a common thing for us, to be honest.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
And you kind of like wonder like why. Yeah, I'm sure that's partly diet, but also it can be, there can be mental health reasons for physical health.
Yeah. I've definitely experienced it. The second, like I said, is an externalizer. And these people are painted as those who live in denial and those who expect others to solve their problems. They're described as impulsive and often distract themselves from their own problems. And they're seen as immature. And they're essentially seen as people who cannot take responsibility for themselves and that often blame others and blame external situations for their misfortune and for their problems. And so they have a lack of responsibility driving them. So a really useful analogy that we came up with to distinguish between the two types is to think of them as appliances. So think of an externalizer as someone that draws their energy from being plugged into the grid, while an internalizer comes with batteries included. I love that. Such a simple analogy. Yeah.
That wasn't us. That was Dr. Gibson.
Oh my God. Okay. I
know. It's like we have like a couple of notes, like, and they're a little bit disorderly. But yeah.
Okay. I won't take credit. I won't take it. I won't take half credit. That's for this anymore. So I wanted to spend like a minute or two just kind of talking about the difference between the internalizer and the externalizer. The book goes into it so deeply and provides so many different anecdotes for internalizers and kind of paints them as this like mature, responsible person that was done wrong and is worthy of healing, whereas the externalizer is kind of discarded and like cast aside. And my problem with this is that I don't think that it paints a, I don't think that the book does a very good job of talking about transitions that can exist between the two and also ways for an externalizer to also find their own healing. So that was my issue with the book. Personally, I feel as though I fell into the externalizer category for a really good portion of my life until things shifted for me in my early 20s. And I completely went into the opposite spectrum. And now I resonate with an internalizer, like 100%. And so I had a very interesting experience. I feel as though the time period where I was an externalizer was me really acting out of pain. I was acting out of pain and I felt as though I didn't get my emotional needs met. And so I was really angry and I was taking it out on the world and not just my parents, but I felt as though I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to take responsibility. I was never shown how. I felt like, why should I take responsibility? No one taught me how to do it and no one gave me what I needed. And so there was a really long period of like confusion for me and a lot of, I didn't even know how to take responsibility, but it was only until my like early 20s when I started to really define like who I am and like what, you know, like what my personal like framework is and what is my like internal compass. So when I started to actually like define those things and I started to like reflect on my childhood and started to reflect on my actions, and when I developed and I cultivated self-awareness, I was able to move into the internalizer. But I do want to say one is not better than the other. Because yeah, I feel like both,
that. That's both, not necessarily
they're not
the
better
goal.
Than the other. It's not the goal. It's not the goal at all. In fact, I'm just saying like I had a very interesting experience because I went from one end to the other. And like as an adult, I realized like the secure attachment was never achieved because you're kind of like you're dilly-dallying like on a spectrum and instead of kind of like finding a healthy middle. And I think that what the book tries to do tries to do the internalizer justice, but doesn't do the externalizer any justice. And I do want to say, if you are, if any listeners have already read the book or are interested in reading the book, just know that both types are unhealthy. And it's also very possible to move from one spectrum to the other, depending on life circumstances. But neither are healthy, and neither are you know, are going to provide you with the healing. It's what we talk about now, like going forward, when we speak about like the maturity, like a awareness approach, some of those strategies that we're going to be talking about very soon. That's what we, you know, that's where we can find our own healing, and that's where we can kind of free ourselves from either the lack of responsibility that we gravitate towards, or the assumption of taking all the responsibility that we may lean towards as an internalizer.
I think that I've always been a little bit of the internalized type. I did not experience switching from one end of the spectrum to another. But like you said, like it's not like either of these are the goal, right?
So no,
I'm
not
working
at all.
In my Yeah, I'm working in my adult life. I mean, one of the traits of the internalizer is being self-reflective, which is fine. That's a good thing. But believing that it's up to them to change things, being in lopsided relationships, like not necessarily good things, right? So this is something I'm working on too, that I can speak to. This leads nicely into the true self and the role self.
So what is the true self and the role self? I had mentioned earlier that loneliness and that lack of emotional intimacy can breed to creating a role self. And I think this even speaks to like what we had talked about like really early on in the episode about the role expectations being projected onto us as children. So the role self is not necessarily something that you have created. I do want to say that you yourself have created. A lot of the times as adults, we have the agency and we have the choice to adopt that role self, like consciously. But I think the role self is something that is very unconscious, and it is a family pattern. It's something that's kind of pushed down to us from previous generations, and we kind of have to adopt it as children. So that's what I want to say. So becoming aware of the role self is a way to break those family patterns. So a good way that you can achieve this is to focus on your relatedness with your parents versus the actual relationship. So how much of the role self do you adopt when you think about your relationship with your parents? Like what is what they have projected onto you? And I'll give an example of, as a child of driven parents, a lot of my relationship was based off of what I could achieve and how much of a high-functioning person I could be, and not being a weak person, someone who's a go-getter, someone who, you know, wasn't given to emotional displays, and not needing anyone and being independent. This was a role that was projected onto me since I was a child. And so anything outside of that was almost seen as like not me, or not someone that I was aspiring to be. But as you know, as we grow up and as we become adults, taking the work to identify our own emotional needs and our own values allows us to break free from the role self. And then you get to actually evaluate the relationship for where it actually is and for what it's based upon. What is the foundation of that relationship? Is it based on relatedness, or is it based on just this role that's been projected onto you that you've fulfilled or been at least aspiring to fulfill for as long as you can remember to have that relationship with your parents? I know that for myself, it's so complicated and so complex because it has been such an evolution. And I think that for any child, it's a bit of an evolution too, as we grow from child to young adult to young adult to grown adult now, like I'm in my 30s. Identifying what my values are and almost like understanding that those are my values that no one has to accept, but that I have to accept and that I have to uphold and live by and not conform to a role self that's been projected onto me. It is a sense of empowerment, and seeing it as empowerment is something that frees me from the shackles of a role self and allows me to build my true self. I don't even think a lot of Desi people understand this until they're married or until they're in relationships, like serious relationships, where they understand that. And at that point, it just becomes really like terrifying because you're like, whoa, like I wasn't even, you know, I didn't, I wasn't even living my true self. I was living a role self, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Part of kind of detaching yourself from the role stuff and realizing what it is, something dangerous I think can happen from that is you start to fantasize that your a parent will change, right?
Oh,
That's really bad. We don't want to fall into that trap, right? So, like, how do we detach ourselves from that? How do we not fall into that trap, right? Like, one of those things is to free yourself from that immaturity by replacing reactivity with observation, right? Just detached observation of what this person is, who they are versus what we are thinking of them to be in our minds. Like, just detached observations and having an awareness of their maturity level and trying to relate to that person in a non-judgmental way. Like, don't try to control the outcome, just try to relate to that person. And that can help you, like, step away from the role self and to live free of the role self and the fantasy that a person will change, which you should never expect of somebody.
Can we talk about the possible implications of that? Let's say that someone has
Yes,
is
please.
actively practicing this, and they and but what happens is when someone is actively practicing this, there are going to be boundaries that they're setting, whether they mention them or not. There will be
Sure.
boundaries that are being felt by both parties. How to deal with parents that can't handle that? What are what like what are, what what's your opinion? What are your thoughts?
I think it comes again from the detached observation. They're gonna say some shit about it, and you're just gonna have to be like, okay, and just let it roll off your so shoulders, you know, whether or not that goes over well with them.
This is tough to do as a South Asian though.
This
This is
is
like
really
really
tough,
tough.
yeah.
Because we're dealing with things like guilt and shame that like immediately follow.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can like recognize, acknowledge the guilt and the shame part of it, then it can be easier at least to set that boundary.
Yeah, I think the healing, we could talk about the healing fantasy a little bit too. The book talks about the healing fantasy and the role self and then the true self and how they all play together. Healing fantasies typically will involve a parent changing or a parent coming to terms with seeing you for who you really are. And though I do think it is possible in very rare occasions and rare moments, I don't think that it's something that always happens. And so that's why it's so important for us to not involve that, you know, that enlightened like moment of like, oh, a parent understanding and realizing what they did to you was wrong and that they, you know, that they don't see you for who you really are. When if you keep working towards that, if that is the only thing that's going to heal you, then you're setting yourself up for failure and you're setting yourself up for a lot of disappointment and pain. Yeah. Like you said, detachment from those expectations and then understanding our parents' limitations rather than, you know, putting them up on a pedestal and seeing them as people that can change their minds and can see you for who you really are.
Yeah, they might change their minds. Maybe all those things will actually happen, but I don't think you should sit around expecting that from a parent that you know is immature, that you've identified as such, right? You have to just kind of have an awareness of the immaturity. And also recognize that people are going to end up getting hurt potentially. And that comes with part of their immaturity where they're not able to realize they're hurt because of XYZ reasons, but it's actually because of something that they did to you that you're now trying to break yourself free out of. And now they're the ones that are feeling like a little bit lost and confused by that boundary that was set. And you have to accept that has to happen. Maybe somebody ends up getting hurt, but you have now broken yourself free of the role stuff, and that's the most important thing. That's the most important part of this. It's kind of like you can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped, right?
No, absolutely. Or even understand that there's something wrong, like inherently wrong with the way that they're approaching the relationship. Like it's almost like you're waiting for like the bubble to burst, but the bubble may never burst.
Yeah. And that brings us to the 1 hour mark. How did we do? I mean, we covered a lot of what we said we were going to cover.
I think we covered it all. I really do.
Listen, not the complete guide to dealing with immature parents as an adult, but I think a good place to get started. So I hope that this has inspired you to look inward and to also look outward and see what it is, identify what it is that you grew up around if you feel as though you grew up around immature parents. And to see it in the context of South Asian light. I know we had like our additions that we had to the book and from the South Asian context, but I do still recommend this book as a read, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, Dr. Lindsay Gibson. Good book, still recommend it. Any final thoughts from you, Anu?
I'm really curious to know what our listeners are thinking and
yes,
what their thoughts are. I guess when we publish this episode, leave some comments. Let us know what you thought. DM us. Give us your your review and just what some of your initial thoughts were to the book itself and to our episodes.
And on that note, I will leave all of our contact info. So this is the Desi Condition. Thank you for listening. We can be found in several ways. We can be reached via email at thedesicondition@gmail.com. You can also find us on Threads at the Desi Condition, also Instagram at the Desi Condition. And where else can people find us? We have a website, tdcpodcast.com, in which we will be posting a bunch of sources from the last episode and this episode for certain facts that we cited throughout the episode. So you can read up more on those topics as well. And I hope that you have a beautiful, safe, wonderful day.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.